go through a brief introduction of Buddhism, talk about meditation a little bit, and then leave some time at the end for us to talk and have questions. And I promise you that as soon as the clock, I go from 6 to 7, but we'll stay till 7:15. But at 7:15, I'm kicking all of you out. We don't get to stay past 17. I didn't do a very good job of that last time, and so I'm making amends for that, keeping people over time in this process. All right. So as we talk about Buddhism, we must talk about the Buddha. The Buddha that was a historical figure, a mythological figure, someone who lived, Siddhartha Gautama, who lived from about 563 to 480 BCE, who in many ways is a legend and legendary. There are countless thousands of myths surrounding the story of the historical figure of the Buddha. And the Buddha was in many ways a challenge to Hinduism, an enigma unto himself. His awakening changed, he changed his identity, and it began to change the identity of Hinduism. But like all great prophets, the Buddha never intended to start a new religion, right? Just like Jesus never intended to start Christianity, just like Martin Luther never intended to start Lutheranism, the Buddha never intended to start a new path or religion, but this is what it came to. So the story of the Buddha that some of you may be familiar with is that he began as a rich prince, someone who was very sheltered, someone who was very protected, someone who didn't experience pain or suffering, who was handed all that he had on a silver platter. And so someone very wealthy. And so what happened as he began to be to grow up and ask questions and be curious, he was protected from the village that was not too far from where he lived. And what happened is what we are now known as the four passing sights. This is a term often used in Buddhism, that as he went down from his village, he encountered four things that began to shape who he became. And that was that he saw an old man who was suffering and withered and hunched over. He saw a very ill and sick man. He encountered a corpse, a dead person, all things that he had never encountered in his life because he'd been protected from those things. Someone of great wealth. And he encountered a holy man with no possessions, someone who was begging, probably a Hindu sannyasin, who was begging for all that he had. And he saw these things, and it really shook him to his core, and he began to ask questions about life and suffering. Those grand questions of life: why does suffering exist? Why do people die? What is beyond here, physically and spiritually? Is there an afterlife? What about reincarnation? Do all of these things exist? What are they all about? And so he went and sat underneath a tree. And this has been known as the Bodhi tree, the awakened tree, as he sat there and he was tempted. So he was there, he fasted. Some say, depending on the myth that you read, some say it was up to 100 days. Some say it was 6 months. There's different myths that are surrounding that story. A long time, basically. And those of you who are familiar with biblical studies know that that word 40 that shows up in the Bible over and over again is more or less something that just means for a while. It's not to be taken literally. It just means for a long time. So here the Buddha was in the desert for a long time, being tempted by the world. It was said that voluptuous women appeared to the Buddha to tempt him. There were flaming rocks. They were offering shortcuts to nirvana. Does anybody seem like this story is familiar? Right? Those of us who know the story of Jesus know that this happens to Jesus. Before Jesus begins his public ministry, goes off to a time in the wilderness, is tempted by the devil, and comes back and begins his public ministry. Very similar story, except the Buddha did it first. That was a little joke. So the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path begin to arrive from his first public address. And the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path become the foundation for Buddhism. If there's anything that you should know about Buddhism, these are the things. And all of the stories of Buddhism, all of the teachings of Buddhism, rest on these concepts and these precepts. It proclaimed his key discoveries that would lay the foundation for a movement. One of my favorite stories about Buddhism is it was said that Siddhartha would go into a village early in the morning, find a tree, sit down, and begin talking and begin teaching to no one. And begin teaching and sharing his insight to the birds, to the creatures on the ground. And eventually, by the end of the day, the whole village would gather there and hear him and his stories. So, what are the Four Noble Truths? All life is suffering. Some of the terminology are just some of the Buddhist terms that we... all life is suffering. Now, this has kind of been translated or a misnomer. It's not this pessimistic worldview, but more so just a reality check, right? If we think about the total sum of our lives, how much of it's spent in a state of suffering, or a state of waiting, or a state of wondering, or a state of anxiety, or a state of stress? Not all life is bliss, right? Those mountaintop experiences are few and far between. The cause of this suffering, the Buddha would say, is desire, is striving, is when we are able to be selfless, we are free. When we let go of the ego, we are another step in this path towards enlightenment. That cause of suffering is desire. To overcome desire, we overcome craving. This is often translated or understood as overcoming attachment. Many people, when we talk about Buddhism, we talk about the idea of non-attachment. Non-attachment to material things. Non-attachment even to...
a yoga class?
Yes, right, exactly. Right? When we get out of our brains a little bit and we realize that all life is just this forward progress that's constantly moving and constantly changing, and we're not attached to any one thing, we do this. And to overcome this desire, we have a formula. It's the Eightfold Path. This is a release from our captivity, a prescription from our torment. Now, the difference between Buddhism and Hinduism is this wasn't some escape from the karmic existence of life. This was just simply a way in which one is to seek enlightenment. The Buddha did not really believe in reincarnation, at least the historical figure of Siddhartha did not, but more of this pathway for us to live in harmony with the world. All right. So, got the Four Noble Truths. The Eightfold Path, so up in your corner, this is a symbol that's seen often in Buddhism, and this is the wheel, the Dharma wheel, it's often called. So if you think about a bicycle, and you have a hub and spoke system, if any one of those spokes is out of true or out of tension, any cyclists in the room, right? No? Anybody? Big? Okay, got some cyclists. So if you have a spoke that's out of true, or it's loose, or it breaks, it makes the whole wheel do this, right? And so this wheel, this eight-sprocketed, or this eight-spoked wheel, all builds off one another. So these are important things. You often see that symbol of the Dharma wheel. We have the right knowledge. This is a re-referencing to the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are the key that unlocks all truth. Right aspiration. This is a singularity in one's focus. Aspiration is about letting go, decluttering one's mind, looking towards the future there. The right speech. Speak truthfully, tactfully. Awareness of our speech, mindfulness of our words. Avoiding lies, gossip, slander, belittling, sarcasm, which sarcasm is a word that means barbed wit, which means I will never be a really good Buddhist because I feel that sarcasm is a fine art. And I'm so guilty of it. It's something I try really hard to not to do, but I think in honesty, it's this huge defense mechanism. Right? When we use sarcasm, it's because we're uncomfortable with the situation or we're unwilling to enter into a situation fully. And so we use sarcasm as this kind of defense mechanism, which I am very good at in that way. The Buddha talked about the right behavior. Do not kill, animals included. Don't lie. Don't commit adultery. Sobriety. Most Buddhists are vegetarian. Most Buddhists don't drink alcohol. Of course, there's always exceptions to this rule, but this is about that right behavior in that way. Right livelihood, taking the right job, The Buddha talked a lot about not working as a politician, not working as a tax collector or an alms maker, or working in the military. So the Buddha's original philosophy was very focused on nonviolence, and he actually received a lot of grief from his government because he spoke out very strongly against any sort of military efforts. And it sort of begs that question, and I think it was, you know, why do we kill people who kill people to show that killing people is wrong? That kind of idea that the Buddha was really insistent on. Right effort, the moral exertion. One of the quotes from the Buddha said, those who follow the way might as well follow the example of an ox. If you know anything about oxen, probably nobody is raising oxen around here, but if you know anything about oxen, you know that if an ox is built and designed to work, and actually oxen will live longer if they work longer. And the Buddha talked a lot about the importance of work and this idea of retiring or relaxing or going on retreats to Holden Village. This was something that the Buddha talked intently about. In all that we do, we ought to be working towards something, even when we're on retreat at Holden Village. The right mindfulness from the Dhammapada, which is a text. The Buddha talks about controlling one's mind, centering on actions, loving kindness, spending hours each day in solitude, reflection, and a kind of what I would call a neurotic intentionality. So what do I mean by neurotic intentionality? That means that every action has a consequence. Whatever we do, whatever we say, however we act, it all has consequences. So this is the African concept of Ubuntu, which means that I am a part of you and you are a part of me, and we all sort of are in this thing together, and my actions impact you, your actions impact me. And so if we think about the world in that way, we'll be more mindful about each step that we take and each bite of food that we put in our mouth. As I was sharing with somebody earlier, for some reason when I'm here, I feel really bad if I don't eat everything that's on my plate. Like, I don't know what that is, but it seems like there's a different kind of intentionality when I'm here and somebody's prepared this food for me. And I know the intense amount of work that's gone into creating the food in the kitchen in this place. And so I feel like the least I could do is eat everything on my plate. But it gets me into thinking about in a different way than I do at home. So there's something I like about this intentionality in all we do. And then finally, number 8 is the right absorption. So this is similar to meditation. This is what Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. Sat there for hours and hours as he was able to clear his mind and began to meditate. So that's a big, quick overview of that. So one of the things we think about, as I shared in my last class, talked about elements of religion, is that if Buddhism... was Buddhism a movement, a religious one, or an attempt to end religion? Recall some of those basic components of religion. So authority, ritual, understanding, traditions, acknowledgement of the divine. In many ways, Buddhism lacks a lot of these key principles. And I'll point some of those out with some quotes from the Buddha. Buddhism's challenge in its beginning, what emerged was a religion totally devoid of authority. Completely devoid of ritual or tradition or an emphasis on sacredness. Now, we know the religion evolved, right? Just as all religions do, when Martin Luther set out to reform the church, right? Martin Luther was not a Lutheran. And, you know, sometimes people think about, like, well, what was his original intent? Certainly not what we have today. Not that today is great. Not great, right? But it was never his desire. So the Buddha never desired to create an entire religion. Eventually, it would evolve into a religious movement, but not at first. So, some of the teachings of Buddha. He says, be lamps unto yourself. That your truth is found within you. He often talked that Brahminic rites, which are Hindu rites, are superstitious petitions offered to ineffectual gods. Well, he chose his words pretty carefully. And he talked about a noble science, a religion devoid of insistence of orthodoxy. I think the word orthodoxy, if we can think about the opposite of that, might be orthopraxis, or the right practice. And so Buddhism, even today, spends a lot of talk and a lot of time talking about the right practice, or orthopraxis, as opposed to orthodoxy, the right belief. It's devoid of tradition. Again, a lot of focus on the individual. He said, there is a path to end suffering, tread it. And a man is not my disciple if he tries to be a miracle worker. Ironically, as history went on, many people divinized the Buddha. Many people said that the Buddha's touch was a miracle. He was a miracle worker. It was magical in a way. The famous parable that the Buddha says is, so often I'm pointing my finger to the moon, and instead of looking at the moon, people get focused on the finger. And so that's what he really believed in, that idea. So what is it then, right? It's not all those things. So what is it? Empirical or immanent understandings don't go by reasoning or inferring or argument. A disciple must know by himself. So the journey is always an individual one. I shared in my last session the Buddhist idea of two men come to the Buddha to ask how they might receive enlightenment. And the first one, the Buddha says to him, you have to sell everything you own. You have to go and give to the poor and become, let go of all your riches. And the guy behind him says, oh, yes, I've got it. I'm on it. I'm ready to do that. And so he comes to Buddha and he says, yes, I'm ready. I'm going to sell everything I'm ready. He says, no. You need to go home and take care of your family. They're missing you. And it's just like, well, wait, what? But this reinforces the idea that everyone's path towards enlightenment is different. There's no one way to get there. In many ways, Buddhism was scientific. It emphasized that importance of lived experience, relying only on theories when they are tested for oneself. Some think that Buddha really was one of the first folks to, in a religious context, to really apply that sort of scientific method, tested theories and ideas. So it was at least initially much more scientific than it was spiritual. Psychological. The Buddha talked about the pathway as an end of the human predicament here on earth, not a promise of heaven. So that was an interesting perspective. In many ways, early Buddhism was very egalitarian. The Buddha, Siddhartha, the original Buddha, talked a lot about the equality of men and women. There's a little bit of irony in that story, because also part of the history is that Siddhartha left his wife and his children to go be a prophet. And so how is it that he's advocating for egalitarian? So not everyone's perfect, right? You can't be a perfect prophet, no one. But it's always directed towards the individual. So it begins to, these are the questions that give, and I'm not going to answer these questions for you. These are just the questions that Buddhism really begins to address, and doesn't really answer these questions, but talks a lot about it. If you really want to dig deep into Buddhist philosophy, these are the questions. You know, are we independent or interdependent on one another? Do we start from a fundamentally good or bad place in our nature? And what is the most important part of human striving, the head or the heart? The answer in all of these questions for Buddhism is yes. Right? That is the answer to these things. It's not, again, just like in Hinduism, it's not an either or, right? It's a both and. What's that?
It's not dualistic.
That's one thing that if we ever really want to grasp Eastern religion, we have to find a way to get rid of this sort of dualistic way of thinking, or this dialectic thinking that it's categorized this or that. And not to go too far on that tangent, but one of the things that Buddhism, at least, is really well known for is its lack of what we might call binary opposition. And so in our society, if we think of binary oppositions, it's this or that, right? You're either male or you're female, you're gay or straight. we're beginning to understand from a human development standpoint that actually gender and orientation is not a binary thing, but more of a spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. And the Buddha actually talked about this, and this was something that was very early understood, that, and Buddha talked about this idea that we're not born completely male or female, we're not completely born as one sexual orientation or another sexual orientation, but we all exist somewhere on that spectrum, right? And so we're beginning to open ourselves up to this idea from a medical standpoint, right? Only in the last 50 years have we begun to say, okay, maybe people that don't exist within the so-called norm actually are not psychologically damaged, or we shouldn't give them a label or a diagnosis. It's just the way people are. And if we really were honest and searched our own hearts, we'll find that probably most of us don't exist on those binaries either. Right? I'm not completely a Democrat or completely a Republican. I'm probably somewhere in the middle, right? You'll never know where. Just kidding. The different branches of the Bodhi tree, the different pathways. So these are the main sort of pathways of Buddhism. Theravada, which means the way of the elders. Mahayana, which is often literally translated as the big raft. The raft terminology comes from the Buddhist parable that talks about the path of enlightenment is like building a raft. You start on one side and you build it and you put it together with the sticks and the leaves and you tie everything together. And as soon as you get across the river, you don't need the raft anymore. Mm-hmm. You let the raft go. And that's part of the Buddhist tradition as well. And so this terminology, the big raft. Mahayana, these are a few different types of Buddhism found within the Mahayana tradition. Most well known is probably the Zen tradition, right? Probably some of you live in a city where there are Zen centers, right? Portland's got a Zen center, Seattle's got a Zen center, San Francisco's got one. Anybody else live close by to a Zen center? I think there's one in Minneapolis. So there's a couple different types. Some of them are, many of the Mahayana traditions are based in Japan. We'll talk about that a little bit more. And then the Vajrayana, or the diamond raft, which we now know as Tibetan Buddhism. So, and again, Tibetan Buddhism, not to go too far off on that tangent, but some of you may be intimately familiar with what's happening in China and Tibet, the region of Tibet, and all of that controversy right now. It's a big mess. And not sure. Anyway, before I keep going, anybody questions about any of this? Questions or comments, observations? I know I'm just going. Yes.
I think when you were talking about that binary, I really like the picture of East and West. That to me is your definition of East and West. Mine. I had the opportunity to live in Hong Kong for 14 years, and the second half of the time we were there, we went took our kids, students, out to baptized baby Buddha to do baptism. And we had a nun out at the nunnery where we were, and she happened to be a graduate of Hong Kong International School. And so I thought, she'll be one who can understand me. She's Chinese, but she could understand me. So I said, I don't get it. How do I know I'm at Nirvana? Yeah, that's exactly what she did. She said, Mrs. Volz, you're thinking the wrong question. I said, no. I just want to know the steps.
How do I get there?
I want to know the steps. It's the Eightfold Path, right?
Right.
No, Mrs. Volz, that's not it. That's not it.
Yeah.
And that's my Western mind. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to detach the Western mind and to think Eastern mind, because Western mind judges the Eastern mind. Right. You're wishy-washy.
Right. And I think that, if one of the ways in which we could kind of grasp or understand Eastern religion is, of course, to understand our own tradition. And I think in many ways, from Western traditions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, we exist in a kind of meritocracy right? We achieve our goal of heaven by our deeds, in a way. Of course, we could argue that theologically. I know faith and works and grace and all that business. We could go there. But we still have embedded within us, even culturally speaking, even if we could argue that Christianity is not a meritocracy, we could certainly argue that the nation we live in is a meritocracy. And I think the Eastern tradition and Eastern culture is very not that. Yes, Lars.
Matt, would you please briefly tell us what Tendai and Shingon Buddhism?
Sure. These are both traditions that exist within Japanese perspective. They evolve over time. Let's see, I think it's on my next slide. Ah, there we go. So this very complicated map with lots of arrows. So we see that Buddhism begins here in India and begins to spread out over this different ways. So these are just different traditions. They all fall within the Mahayana traditions, primarily culturally and geographically specific. And so, yeah, if you take my Eastern religions class at the community college, I will tell you all about those traditions. But mainly it's a geographic location, but it's the importance that it's within that one tradition.
But some forms of Buddhism have chanting and other forms have meditation or more practice.
Yeah. So the Zen tradition, which I'll talk about, I'm going to go in and talk a little bit about the Zen tradition. They're all intertwined with a lot of cultural differences. Zen tradition tends to focus a lot on meditation.
Yeah.
The Tibetan Buddhism tends to be a lot more philosophical in nature. Tendai and Shingon tend to focus, there's a lot of martial arts componentry and what we might call the right absorption of yoga incorporated in some of those things. I believe that Tai Chi comes out of the Tendai tradition, so some of those things as well.
Nichiren is chanting.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, Nichiren is known often for the kind of the chanting and the what we know sometimes is characterized as the alms. The long sustained, alm. You know, this comes out of the Nichiren tradition. They've been known to do that for hours upon hours to obtain a sort of heightened state of awareness. Yeah, good question. All right, so this gives you an idea of what happens. And again, lots of words and arrows and stuff. But what I want your takeaway to be of this is that it begins, this is the Bodhi tree, the Bodh Gaya, which begins as the birthplace of Buddhism. But it begins to spread out and takes hold in China and Japan and Thailand and Cambodia, Vietnam, modern-day Burma, all of these places, but doesn't take a really strong hold in India. And as we think culturally, so we look at Japan and China, they're culturally still heavily influenced by Buddhist practice. Also influenced by Confucius practices as well, too, but that's another class. All right. So, one spoke in the wheel, right? Absorption or meditation. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that because I believe that, at least from my perspective and as I've studied Buddhism, this sort of idea of right absorption is the closest we get to finding compassion within ourselves and compassion with others, because what it focuses heavily on is acceptance, right? Acceptance of who we are and where we're at. Part of this tradition is that in this right absorption or in this mindfulness and meditation, it's about acknowledging where we're at and not judging it, right? Which is so hard to do, right? We in this Western society, we're always striving to get somewhere. And once we get there, then we're like, okay, let's create a new place to strive to, and then a new place to strive to. How many of us have spent much of our lives climbing a ladder just to climb another ladder, to climb another ladder, right? And we can climb those ladders until we're in our graves. I think what I recognize, and as I've talked to people around Holden Village, a lot of people come here because they're tired of climbing that ladder, right? Some people, and this is just my observation, and we have the director in the room, so he can argue with me, but my observation of Holden Village is that you have a lot of people who are on the young end of life, and a lot of people who are on the older end of life, right? There are these two stages, and these are the highly representative groups, because in some ways these are the places one people can afford to do that, because you either don't have a lot of responsibilities or you've done all that responsibilities. And I've talked to both of those groups of people in those ages, and they're here for the same reason, right? And part of that is that they believe that there's a different way of being in the world than that striving. And if there's a way we could take the village down into the rest of our life, right? And so when I lead retreats with people, when we're off in the wilderness, I always say, be very careful about saying good luck back in the real world. We say that. We say, oh, you know, hope you have a good time back in the real world. No. This is the real world, right? That world out there, that's the fabricated world. That's the competitive world. This is where we are in most in touch with realness, I believe. I'm getting philosophical in my nature. But anyway, I saw a hand go up back there. Was that true, or are you just stretching? Okay, just doing yoga back there. Okay. All right. So, meditation. This is from Joseph Goldstein. Meditation begins with calming the mind and collecting the attention. In addition to the feelings of restfulness and peace, the state of concentration also becomes the basis for deepening insight and wisdom. We find ourselves opening to the world's suffering as well as to its great beauty. Right? And this is a sticker that I have on my, and if you can't read it, it says, come on, inner peace, I don't have all day. and I have that on my door at my office, in my office. So. All right. So I'm going to consider meditation for just a little bit. What is it? Is it different than prayer? What about mindfulness? What are its benefits? Not to steal the thunder of the meditation class that's coming up, but that I think is an important part of Buddhism that we'll talk about. From its roots in Latin, meditation comes from the word to measure, mette, or the word meditare, which is a verb. That means to contemplate or think or to ponder. So to measure as we're thinking and we're pondering, to analyze, to observe, right? Nowhere in this is it judging, right? Just awareness, being able to measure, to judge something, to say, okay, this is too long or too short or good enough or not good enough. It's simply awareness. Meditation is also described as consideration or a quest for the truth about ourselves, truth about our neighbors, truth about higher realities. Now, this isn't like gossip, or this isn't about, you know, really know what's going on behind closed doors, but the true nature of who we are, right? If any of you are friends of Brené Brown, right, this is vulnerability, right? This is about vulnerability. This is about acknowledgement, who our true selves are, without judgment. All right. Thomas Merton is one of my favorite people in the whole world. He's a bridge between Eastern and Western religious ideology. Some of you are probably familiar with Merton. He's an American monk in the Roman Order of Trappists who studied Buddhism in great length. He talked a lot about meditation. He talked a lot about the connection between the East and the West. Meditation is a movement from knowing certain ideas and realities towards living those ideas. In other words, incorporating knowledge in our daily practice or practices. So it's in many ways what Merton talked about was meditation was a way for us to develop rhythms in our lives, to develop certain rhythms. When we're here at Holden Village, there's a certain rhythm to the day. It seems to me by about the third day, I realize how slow it is. Right? And it's like, it's still Tuesday? It's Wednesday, by the way. But it's still Wednesday. But it's a beautiful thing, right? Because time begins to slow down and the rhythms begin to change. And you hear the bell ring and you say, oh, is it time to eat again? Right? Like, all time is slow, but it seems like we eat all the time. Right? But meditation is about taking those ideas and developing a new rhythm to our lives. Contemplative practices and meditation can lead in the same direction, but not necessarily the same motive, right? So we're not too quick to say prayer and meditation are the same thing, because they're just not. Unity, love, union, yoke, connectivity, can all be words that describe the objective of prayer, but the object may be different. Where we direct this to, and I'll talk, let me say what I mean by that. To whom or for whom is basically what I'm saying. The object or the direction may be the distinguishing factor that separates prayer and meditation. To God or for God, to the universe, for the universe, for healing of self that is imminent or transcendent, right? Is it within or is it outside? Meditation moves beyond thinking things out. It's guided by love and a desire to heal oneself, one's community, one's nation. Sounds similar to prayer, right? So it can go there.
Yeah. It's also a more of awareness, though.
Yeah.
It's, I would call it more of, like, for example, we're teaching mindfulness in our elementary schools, going in and reminding students to, you know, take time for themselves or even leading small, like, 5-minute sessions, which can be extremely hard for those students to kind of, and again, that's like that non-judgment, just kind of, just, you know, have your thought, breathe in, let it out. And that can be tough. But I see it more as just that, where are you right now? Kind of a check-in. And that can be tough for kids.
One of the most popular forms of meditation in the Zen tradition is it seven?
It's dinner.
No.
It's dinner. Okay, Stephanie. Okay, thanks, Dan, for your service. And one of the most popular forms of meditation in the Zen tradition is something that's called Zazen, where you just simply sit with your legs folded in a lotus position, and your right hand usually goes on the palm of your left hand, and you just are aware, and you sort of focus on lengthening yourself, just lengthening your body. It's something that can be done in a chair, even, too. And one of the things that I always like to do is, you're sitting in a chair, and you put your feet flat, so don't cross your legs, but just put them flat. You can do this if you want. And if you put them on your flat, and you there's these little balls on the end of your toes, right? And they have incredible power, incredible strength in those balls of your toes. And if you just push those in, and it's like you're just going to tear through the floor, right? And then you let go, you have a sensation of lightness. It's a beautiful, it's just one little simple thing you can do. You know, just push it as hard as you can, and then just let go, and your body just begins to feel light. I do that at work all the time when I have to talk to my staff. I've got some difficult staff people. But when I get back from sabbatical, they're going to be transcendent and beautiful. So lots of different kinds of meditation out there. There could be about breathing, about centering oneself, mindfulness, music meditation. Loving kindness is a form of meditation. You can do a YouTube search of loving kindness meditation. It's a beautiful way to do a very short one where you focus on loving kindness of yourself, loving kindness of those around you. It also very specifically asks you to focus on someone or some ones that you're struggling with and ask for loving kindness on that individual. So back to my staff. When I do loving kindness meditation and I say, I'm going to ask that for the best of the best for my staff people, to believe that they're doing the best that they possibly can, and I want to project love and kindness onto them. When I interact with them after that, it's like I see a different person, right? And then I forget about it, and then I'm, you know, then I have to go back to my office and do it again later. But it's just having these little, and this is part of, you know, the Lojong tradition, which is another tradition within Zen. One of the things it talks about is just focusing on mantras or slogans, and just having one or two per day that you can just repeat and do. And I find that those are just, one of those I found within the tradition is that people are doing the best that they can. People are doing the best that they can. If I repeat that all day long, it takes a lot of my judgment away. I'm able to walk a little bit lighter on the earth. It doesn't mean I still don't get angry at people, but it allows me to interact with them differently. Well, there's particular types of meditation where we scan our whole body, noticing how we feel in our hands and our feet and our legs and our body, our neck. This gets harder as I get older, right? Because I have more creaks and pains and everywhere. And of course, yoga meditation or any physical exercise can be kind of meditation. What are the goals of meditation? So it's union, right? This is the word yoke, which comes from the word yoga. It's the word yoke, which means union, to connect with God, with the universe, with humanity, with oneself. Preparation to be in the world, live in the world, create peace in the world. My favorite image of the yoke, and Jesus talks about the yoke, right? If you know anything about farming, what you're talking about when you say, when Jesus talks about, take on my yoke, and my yoke is light, and I'll take your burdens. If you yoke two animals, right, if you know this contraption, you put two animals together in a kind of device where they're side by side, you have to find two people who are on this, two animals, if you're yoking cattle or oxen, that are approximately the same weight, that are equal with one another. And so Jesus, in many ways, when he talks about taking on his yoke, is saying to become one with him. To realize we're on the same place and the same, to find ways to connect in that way and union with Christ in that way. I wish I had so much more time. I do.
Go back two slides to the Atman in Hinduism.
So the Hindu Atman, which is the truest self. So this is something I talked about in my last session. The Atman is a focus on the truest and most, the deepest self, and what it focuses on is if we can believe in ourselves and know ourselves, then we find a deeper connection with the people of the outside world. So it's just a way of distinguishing the self outside of, the other way to think about it is, here's a question that I like to think about, is who were you before people told you who you were, right? Okay, so this is the Hindu Atman, is the person that you were, that you are, before you listened to the people who told you who you were or who you are. And so how many of us are still listening to other people tell us who we are, right? But who are we deep down? Parker Palmer talks about this a lot too. If any of you know Parker Palmer, talks a lot about that true, undivided self. He's one of my favorites. Questions? I also have my email up there if you want to stay in touch with me. I'd love to hear from you. It's Heart of Corvallis. Any questions, comments, observations, rebuttals? I'll take it all.
I'm just curious, why did Buddhism not take hold in India? I mean, it's in the Hindu context and work elsewhere.
So, there's a lot of historical reasons, but my biggest guess is that as Hinduism and India were such an intertwined culture, we can go back to talk about the Silk Road, we can talk about some of the pragmatic agricultural and industrial practices that began to move things towards that direction, but it also had to do with, culturally speaking, there were a lot of Brahmins or Hindu priests that weren't too thrilled about Buddhism, and so that was part of that. And there was a lot of things happening around the same time. So you had the rise of, so there's the Old Testament prophets were being written down about the same time that Buddha was coming. It's at a time in the history called the Axis Age. There's a lot of things happening in that time period. My guess is it had both to do with some pragmatic industrial things happening, but also that Brahmin priests weren't too thrilled with the idea. Because, you know, a religion without authority, we remember the caste system, right? They, you know, if I was a priest in the caste system and somebody said, well, you know, priests aren't that important, I'd go, ooh, wait a minute. So it's some of that as well, I think.
Well, I was going to ask you about kind of a spinoff, so there are no clerics.
No, so some Buddhist traditions have monasteries, they have monks and nuns, but this is more of a life of service. And so you'll find Buddhist temples do have leaders and stuff, but not in the same, it's a very lay-led movement. You won't find an ordination process like you do, or a hierarchy in most of those traditions as well. Yeah, Lars.
Do you know more of the story of Thomas Merton? What I understand is that he was in Southeast Asia making connections with Buddhists, mm-hmm. and he was kind of making a connection that said maybe we shouldn't be in Vietnam in that war, and he got into a little trouble with our government. Do you know any of that?
Yeah, so he was someone who was very, found a deep resonance with the nonviolence found in that young man. That's probably what pulled him in. He was there traveling in that region partially on a effort to proselytize that region. Instead, what he found was this deep sense of connection and resonance with the people there. It was also around the time of Vatican II, so things were changing dramatically in the Catholic tradition, where this emphasis on the exclusivity of the gospel was shifting a little bit, and there was more of an openness towards different faith traditions, and more conversations about interfaith dialogue and pluralism and things like that were happening as Vatican II, you know, had just on the heels of that as well. You know, I would say the person that probably more likely got, you know, more, you can look at the story of Thich Nhat Hanh, which was a contemporary as well. Thich Nhat Hanh probably got in more trouble with several governments, his own government, or this government, and stuff like that, than Thomas Merton did.
Yeah.
Thomas Merton probably wasn't too much of a threat. So, other questions? Yeah, thanks.
I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what the biggest differences are. Like, I get the finger pointing in Hinduism versus Buddhism is different. So the structure of the Eightfold Path versus the Ayurvedic texts.
Mm-hmm.
But from a spiritual or philosophical perspective, what do you see are the biggest differences between the two?
So the big difference between Hindu and Buddhist tradition?
Yeah.
I think what I see from what I know is culturally, a lot is cultural. And again, if we're more in depth, so you find a lot of Buddhism found root within Chinese and Japanese culture. Distinguishing, and whereas in Hinduism is still deeply entwined with Indian culture. What's Hindu culture? What's Indian culture? It's very difficult to parse those things out. I think that Buddhism tends to have a much more, I would say, ironically, contemporary Buddhism has a much more communal focus. It has much more emphasis on the welfare and the well-being of the larger community than Hinduism does. Certainly nowadays, too, with the current Indian Prime Minister leading that in a very different nationalistic direction. We could talk about nationalism for a while, too.
And I would say, too, the God, the understanding of the God. And Buddhism does not have that supreme being. And if you go to India, depending upon where you are, you're going to see, quote, gods. And I'm saying that in quote, because it's really Brahma is one God, but then it's how the different individuals see that God. So I would tell my kids, it's like the Holy Spirit. Well, you know, the dove. Oh, yeah, okay. And then when I tell them about Ganesh, the elephant god, oh, that's ridiculous. What's the difference?
Right.
In the dove? But anyway, so then the people will center on the attributes of Brahman, of God, and that becomes such a focus even to the different parts of India. So
I think
Buddhism
that's,
kind of
went, right on.
Oh, we don't have a god. I don't have to worry about doing homage to that god.
Yeah.
I have to figure it out here.
I think that's a great observation. And I think that's right. There's some veneration of gods and goddesses within the Tibetan tradition.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction as well. I would say, if we go back to the words immanence and transcendence, within Hinduism, there's a lot more room for this idea of transcendence, of the divine outside of us that's impacting, whereas Buddhism tends to really focus on that immanence that we're founded within. And when we are deeply connected with ourselves, we can become more connected with our neighbor, right? And when we're more connected with our neighbor, we can be more connected with ourselves. But it's something that's the fabric of that is more within us. Whereas I think Hinduism allows for this idea of the spirituality of the universe that it's coming back to us somehow. So I think that's right on. Yeah.
Can you talk more about Zen Buddhism specifically?
Yeah, so Zen Buddhism is one of the first offshoots of Mahayana, which is a tradition very, very much focused on meditation, very focused on practices that bring us into a higher consciousness. So if you were to visit a Zen center for a weekend, say, you would find yourself doing a lot of work. Zen practice, if you go as a student of Zen, you learn how to work in mindfulness and meditation in all the things you do. So whether that be sweeping the floor, or whether that be cleaning, or whether that be walking, all of these things can develop a certain rhythm where we find ourselves in meditation and all these ideas. So, for example, one of the practices in Zen meditation is what I mentioned, Lojong meditation, that focuses on daily tasks becoming meditative practice. And so Zen is very focused on that. Zen's primarily, if I get this right, very focused in Japanese culture as well. Zen is also a very popular form of Buddhism in this country. Mm-hmm. So it came in the 1960s. In many ways, and as the immigration acts in the 1965 came, we had an influx of Chinese and Japanese immigrants to this country. Many of them brought Zen. Meditation took root in San Francisco and then began to spread. Zen Buddhism is probably the most prevalent form of Buddhism found in this country that you'll find out there. Yeah.
What would you say is one of the largest misperceptions that Westerners have about Buddhism?
One of the largest misperceptions of Buddhism. I think one of the largest misperceptions in Buddhism is that it's all about self-actualization, you know, and about being, and there's a great paradox in that, right? Because Buddha did talk about being a lamp unto yourselves, right? Buddha did, there is this great paradox, but the whole point of that is so we can exist more peacefully with the rest of the world. But it does focus on oneself. But most of one of the misperceptions, a lot of Westerners will go, oh yeah, this is great because this is all about finding my inner peace, right? No. You have to get there first in order to become more connected with the rest of the world. It's almost like a step procedure, right? I can't possibly be compassionate and loving towards you if I hate myself, right? If I'm a pastor to a group of people, but I go home every night and I drink myself silly, right? Mm-hmm. There's a huge disconnect right there. I can't possibly love my people if I don't love myself. And so I think that perception of self-actualization, to believe that we are in the myth of individualism, right? Mm-hmm. That we in this country have really bought into this myth of individualism, that I think sometimes we take this Buddhism and we go, oh yes, yes, this can bring me into my self-actualization. This is about me, I'm being a lamp. And you know what? Screw everybody else. Yeah, I had to catch myself there. That was mindfulness. I'm working on my language, my swearing. I think that's a big thing, you know. And I think we can see that in, you know, as I mentioned in my last class, I always do a class every term. It's called Lululemon and Hinduism. And it talks about how even yoga, practice of yoga, has become monetized, right? And has become part of the capitalistic machine, which is so far from what it intends to be, right? This is not the whole intent of yoga, right? But it becomes this sort of popular, this fad thing. It is this incredibly narcissistic thing, you know, about how good I look and make sure I wear the right ones and has the... I honestly couldn't pull off. Maybe I'm just jealous because I couldn't pull off pink, the Lululemon pants. I don't know. You know, it's a popular brand of yoga clothes. Yeah.
This might be really basic, but can you talk about the role of the Dalai Lama in the practice of Buddhism or in the structure of Buddhism?
Yeah, so the Dalai Lama is specifically focused on sort of Tibetan Buddhism. Dalai Lama, and there's the development of Tibetan Buddhism in a particular region of China. Let's go back to the map here. Maybe. Oh, here we go. So Tibetan region's about here. So there's the region of Tibet, and it was at one time a sovereign nation. then China realized there was a lot of rich minerals underneath Tibet, and so they had interest to get there. And so they sought to get rid of all of those people who lived in Tibet. Some of those were those who had developed this philosophy and ideology of Tibetan Buddhism. That the Dalai Lama is unique to Tibetan Buddhism, and the political issues going on right now. So let's see if I can sum this up really quickly. So there's what's called the Dalai Lama and then what's called the Panchen Lama. And the Panchen Lama is, his role is to choose the next Dalai Lama. So this is within the Tibetan tradition. Well, when the most recent Panchen Lama was about 5 years old, he was kidnapped by the Chinese government and taken away and lived in a safe house. So now, at this point, he would be 25, I think it was 20 years ago. I'd have to look that up. And so there's still a lot of conflict between China and Tibet. There's still a lot of people, you might know some of the stories of people who have set themselves on fire in protest of that. So the Dalai Lama, who's getting pretty old at this point, it's a specific relationship. Dalai Lama is seen as the not supreme authority, but as the prophet of that particular branch of Buddhism. So it sets itself apart in a really unique way from other forms of Buddhism.
But he doesn't live there.
But he doesn't live there. You're right.
Yeah. When he was young.
Yeah.
And they're centered now in India.
Right.
And then, thanks to Beijing, they're moving all the Han Chinese into Tibet and then pushing the Tibetan Chinese out. The Han are the major Chinese people.
If you ever really want a really good, precise, and hilarious perspective, Google John Oliver Dalai Lama. It's absolutely hilarious. Very John Oliver is a comedian, but he does this really great explanation of the Dalai Lama and the historical and the current day reality of the Dalai Lama. So, yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
How do people end up in Buddhist monasteries? I mean, I gather there's no process.
It's a strictly volunteer way. I mean, if you become a Buddhist monk or nun, there are orders just not too different than contemporary orders in Catholicism or other traditions where you take vows of chastity and poverty in most cases. That's really it's a commitment. Most Buddhist centers require, depending on the tradition, require a certain length of time or ask you to commit to a year or 5 years, or some, there aren't a lot of like for lifers, what I call, for lifers in the Buddhist tradition. Monasteries tend to be a section. Some people, when they get to be a retirement age, they go into a monastery. Like Holton Village, there's a lot of really young people, and there's a lot of retired people who are Buddhist monks and nuns. So, anybody else?
Yeah. You can't be a Buddhist unless you're a vegetarian, correct?
Not really. I mean, you can. So one of the things that's unique about Buddhism and all Eastern traditions, or most Eastern traditions, is a lack of orthodoxy. So they would say, yeah, if you're going to practice the Eightfold Path, it's probably a good idea to become a vegetarian. But no Buddhist is going to say, you can't be a Buddhist if you don't do this, whether it be vegetarian or anything else, really. It's Tibetan Buddhism is probably the more orthodox tradition, in some ways, but even in that tradition, you're not going to find a Buddhist who says, you have to do this or you can't be a Buddhist in the way that which we do in Western traditions. Okay, I think I'm out of time. Thank you very much for coming.